Okay, so today we're having the second of the astrophysics programmatic talk. Piero Madao.
Madao. Yes.
Will tell us about black holes in the universe. And what I was planning to do in 2 weeks, a week from Monday, is the staff holiday at the IPC. So we'll skip a week from Monday, but in 2 weeks we'll hopefully have some other than programmatic research bring to this audience. Before I turn the floor over, let me tell you, inform you that the ITP spring picnic will be in about 2 months, almost 2 months, sometime in the middle of May. And but the reason I'm telling you this is that there's an old new tradition, or a new old tradition established. There are lots of seats over around. Established at the IGP, namely of the programmatic football game, which occurs at the picnic, in which, in this case,
football, not soccer. Soccer or football?
Soccer.
Sorry.
Or as it's known in Europe, football.
Football.
Which in this case, the quantum black holes will take on the astrophysical black holes. May the weather prevail. Now, the reason I'm telling you this way ahead of time is that this is our training. Not only that, so the rules of this game are that the two programs are in opposition to each other. But there are a lot of other people around here who aren't necessarily associated with each program, and they're up for grabs. So I want to give you fair notice that you can try to recruit students, postdocs, even prominent members. Anyway, let's go back to black holes.
Back to black holes. Yes, in fact, this talk was sold to me as an informal talk, and now I find out that I'm being recorded, and that everything I write on the blackboard will be put on the web. So
everything informal in recorded.
In fact, I'd like to apologize about the generic title "Black Holes in the Universe." 10 minutes ago, I got a phone call. Somebody asked me, "What is this about?" I have to decide whether I'm coming to your talk or not. I don't know whether. I didn't get the name, so I don't know whether whether he is in the audience. So I said, well, it's sort of about cosmology, and he said, okay, and hanged up. So I don't know whether I got the right words, or I scared him. Anyway, what I'd like really to talk today is massive black holes in galactic nuclei. And so there are four sort of main topic that I'd like to briefly discuss: statistics of black hole, and this is again supermassive black holes, it'll be clear what I mean in a while, in nuclei of galaxies. So first, second, the contribution of accretion onto black hole to the total amount of extragalactic background lights that we see today in the universe. Optical IR. Then I'm going to talk about the quasar era. After all, accretion onto supermassive black hole, we believe, gives origin to quasars, and quasar activity seems to peak at a redshift with around z equal 3. So I'll discuss that, and then at the end I'll discuss evidence for early black holes, or if you want, for AGN activity at very early time, z equal 5 is the redshift when the universe was less than 10% of the current age. So I was also told that I don't have to I don't can't show any transparencies. I'm not going to show them. In fact, I'm going to going to circulate them between. But I think, in case you wonder whether you know there are real calculation behind what I'm going to say towards the end, these are a couple of simulations. Some people believe simulations more than back of the envelope calculation. So you know, these are for my astrophysics colleagues, and you know, if you want, we can discuss that. So in the last few years, there has been strong evidence that local galactic nuclei contain black holes with masses in the range, in fact, between 10 to the 6 and few by 10 to the 9 solar masses. Now, there are 15 best studied cases. These are nearby galaxies. We have high-resolution spectroscopy, typically with the Hubble Space Telescope, and imaging, plus detailed modeling. And in all these cases, there is evidence for what is called a massive dark object. This means typically that the mass-to-light ratios in these central compact objects in solar unit is about 100. So the sun, for the sun, this mass-to-light ratio is 1. In this case, in the nuclei of galaxies, nearby galaxies, this mass-to-light ratio is about 100, and there are associated velocities, circular velocities, of order 1,000 km per second. Now, what is done usually in most of these cases, I mean, the common denominator of all these studies, is you identify test particles, either stars or gas clouds, then you get their velocity at a given radius, and then V square equals alpha gm over r, and if you are lucky, alpha is of order unity, in the case you have a disk, and then you get, basically, given a velocity and the radius, you get your mass. In some cases, it's more complicated than that. You end up with anisotropic velocity dispersion, and so you have to model it. But in the case of disk of gas or stars, the analysis is typically straightforward. There are three best studied cases. One is our own galactic center. The mass there, it's 2.6 10 to the 6 solar masses. And this estimate is done through proper motions of stars at distances from the nucleus less than point, or if you want, from the massive dark object less than a percent of a parsec. That means the density, mass density associated with this estimate, it's about 10 to the 12 solar masses per cubic parsec. It's huge. It's the 12 order of magnitude higher than the density in the solar neighborhood. So in this case, it is so dense that all the three cases I'm going to talk about, these are all strong black hole candidates. And then by inferences, people think that even the massive dark objects that we see in all unambiguous case are also black holes.
The six
clusters, there could be cluster of compact objects. And there are constraints there on evaporation time scale, etc. But, you know, they are not, this is pretty unambiguous. The other cases are dark objects. You could have a cluster of black holes, small black holes, difficult to rule out, neutron stars, etc., etc. The other case is NGC 4258. And here we see water maser. So we have an incredibly good estimate of what the velocity is. In fact, the velocity is Keplerian. It's a gas disk of velocity about 10,000 kilometers per second at radii of 0.13 parsec. So again, from this you get a mass density of order 10 to the 9 solar masses per cubic parsec. In fact, the mass that you estimate in this case for the black hole that you not write down is 3.6 10 to the 7. And since it's water measure, you can really get very good velocity measurement. The delta V, the velocity difference, or if you want the maximum non-Keplerian velocity that you can allow, it's about 3 kilometers per second. So those are great data. Last case is M87. M87 gives one of the most massive black holes that we know in the nearby universe. Total mass is 3 by 10 to the 9 solar masses. We also have evidence for black holes in AGN. The best studied case is a Cipher 1 galaxy. It's an active nucleus. I'm not going to bother. Well, okay. For the astronomy colleagues, this is the phone number. Did I write the mass? I don't think I wrote the mass of this, but we saw K alpha line of iron at 6.4 kV with typical velocities of over 100,000 kilometers per second. 100,000. And you also see an asymmetry in the line profile towards the red, and that's consistent with gravitational redshift. And Mitch is here. What's the mass? Do you remember the mass? Sorry?
We don't know the mass.
You don't know?
Probably about 10 to the 7th, but you can't get the mass just from the line profile.
Right, right. But I thought the argument was it's still few, it's few Schwarzschild radii, right?
Yeah.
But
yeah. And it's variable on the time still
out. Right.
Is it understood here why in this case the velocity is so much higher?
It's very close. We are talking, well, it's just distance from the central hole. So this is, yeah, it's few Schwarzschild radii, so it's probably the inner edge of the accretion disk, 3 or 4 or 5. Or inside, in some model.
It's so broad that it may be inside the innermost stable.
Oh, okay, so for some reason this one is measured very close to the center.
Yes, it's because it's gas and it's X-rays. So you can probe the inner region of the accretion disk. In some cases, it's stellar dynamics. In the other case, it's gas, but it's still far away at a fraction of a parsec. So here we are talking, well, we don't know the mass, but presumably we are talking about 10 to the 12, 10 to the 13 centimeter, if not closer. In the other cases, we are 10 to 17 centimeters. Mm-hmm. So, but the end point of all this, if you had these 15 cases, in fact, there are other 20 candidates, or if you want, galaxies that have been studied with less good data. But the common understanding is that there seems to be evidence that there is a black hole in the center of all nearby galaxies, hence, by definition, of all galaxies. So that's what I'm going to assume next.
Could you say a little bit more about that? I mean, is the evidence every time you look, right, very carefully?
Every time you have good data, yes. Every time you have good data with HST. Sorry?
There are galaxies, for example, M-star district, but there is no.
Right, right, right. But I mean, we are talking about, let me put in 90% of the cases or where you have good data, then you do find evidence for it. That's massive dark objects.
But the evidence is based on 45
days. Yeah, it's in fact 35, yes. So I'm going to assume that what everybody does these days is that 35 is good enough.
But you say there are some cases where the evidence is conclusive that there is not a black hole.
Yeah. Yes, and that was
M33. It might be a black hole, but it's small.
But it's very small. I mean, at a certain point, of course, you run out of sensitivity. So if the mass is very small, then there isn't much you can say.
Okay.
So we don't know whether there is no black hole or whether it's just particularly small.
What's the upper bound on the mass if there were such?
It's probably, I don't think we are sensitive to, the data are not sensitive to masses less than 10 to the 6.
Does that galaxy otherwise look different than the others?
These galaxies?
No, M33.
Yeah, it moves
in front. In terms of the light profile nearby, near the center.
No, aside from the fact that it is a different type of galaxy.
No. In fact, in all these cases, I mean, you do see evidence for these objects, for black holes, in elliptical spirals, etc.
So is this something that the theorists can explain away, M33 anomalous because...
To go into that, not on MF33. No. Let's go ahead and then we'll see what happens.
Excuse me, one more question.
Yeah.
Does all the evidence come from light curves that is measuring the velocity, or is there some independent evidence from the velocity dispersions?
People used to look only at light profiles, but now people use, for the galactic centers, you can just see the stars, you do orbits.
Mm-hmm.
And the same is true. The same is true for some of the base data that I showed. Well, the water maser you get just, gas. So, if you look at those 35 cases, there is a relationship between black hole mass and the mass of the bulge of the galaxy. So, the bulge of the galaxy is the inner part of the galaxy. Is the oldest component of the galaxy. In the case of elliptical galaxies, contains most of the mass. For spiral, it is a sizable fraction, maybe 50%. The relation is that the mass of the black hole is about 0.6% of the mass of the bulge. Okay? Now, in what I'm going to say in a moment, I'm going to assume in a Stein-Bessy universe, I have to do some cosmologies here, so omega matter equal 1, H naught equal 50. Sorry? An antithesis cosmology. That one?
Five dimensions.
Okay. Fine. So in that cosmology, the total mass density, it's 7 by 10 to the 10 solar masses per megaparsec cube. That's omega matter equal 1. So that's the critical density. The baryons from deuterium measurement, nucleosynthetic baryons, are 5.5 10 to the 9. I'll have to check this number before you put those on the web, but I think...
It's a 0.5.
Yeah, it's probably 0.4 or something. That's the baryon mass density. And it's 0.08. Yes. So it's almost 10%.
That's luminous baryon, right?
No, okay. These are nucleosynthetic baryons.
Oh, from nucleosynthetic.
The luminous baryons are 5, 10 to the 8 solar masses per cubic megaparsec. Okay, so about 10% of the baryons that we see are luminous. Now about 50%, this is in stars, in galaxies, about 50% of this it's in the in bulge component of galaxies. And so from these relations, that means that the black hole mass density, as seen today, is 1.5, even though I take a factor of a few, I didn't put any error bars to that relationship. But anyway, 1.5, 10 to the 6 solar masses per cubic megaparsec. So in other words, every 10 to the 4 baryons in the universe, 90 are in stars, 3 in black holes, in fact, really black holes. Okay? What are the implications of that? Well, how much energy density is associated, in fact, radiation energy densities is associated with this number. Now, let's look at stars first. Well, we have rho stars there, c squares, times the metallicity. In other words, we take that amount of baryons, a fraction of those are burned into metals, that's the solar value, that's about 0.02. And then by burning protons into helium and heavier elements, we get an efficiency of mass conversion into radiation of the usual 0.7%. So this number, if you use solar here, it's about 10 to the 5 solar masses per cubic megaparsec. This is all density. Now, so what I said here is that we have a census of the stars in the universe today. Stars have typical metallicity that are close to solar. Most of those are. And so this is the amount of radiation that I've burned through nuclear reaction to produce that amount of metals. Now, one of the uncertainties here that people are discussing is that we don't know if there are lots of metals not within stars but in the intergalactic medium. In other words, it's possible that during galaxy formation and star formation, a lot of metals are in fact produced and ejected in the intergalactic medium. If that's true, that number would go up, probably by a factor of a few. In fact, we know that that's happening in clusters. Most of the metals in cluster of galaxies are associated with the gas and not with the stellar component. In fact, that
some sort of opacity argument why the stuff doesn't recollapse.
You're talking the clusters or?
Well, you eject the matter out.
Yes.
Metals, and then so why doesn't it make stars?
Well, supernovae. I mean, you probably eject metals through supernovae.
Right.
And if a lot of metals are formed in shallow potential wells, like dwarf galaxies, for example, then you can get ejecta that are, you know, unbound.
Mm-hmm.
And they just go into the IGM. And they stay there. They don't go back. They would stay hot, and that's why we don't see them locally. Now, we have evidence for metals everywhere in the universe. So spread metal in the intergalactic medium is equal to 3. Well, I'm an alpha forest, has metals in it. We see carbon 4 absorption. So there are metals in the intergalactic medium at high redshifts.
But if we're not looking at stars from the first generation stars, we think that they would have formed from this material.
Right. And now I'm not saying that all metals are ejected. I'm saying when you do a census of the metals that we see today, we only see the ones that are in galaxies. We have no way to probe locally the intergalactic medium because that gas could be hot and maybe we need X-ray or something, but we don't know. And so a fraction of those metals could be ejected. So that's the uncertainty there. What about black holes? Well, we have this mass density in black holes times c squared times the efficiency of accretion. The efficiency of conversion due to accretion or conversion of rest mass density into radiation. We say the accretion is awarded 10%. We get, again, this number is within a factor of 2, 10 to the 5, comparable to this. Solar mass is c squared for an efficiency of 10% megaparsec and minus 3.
What is
it? The efficiency over which you turn accreting matter into radiation. So if you want, it's the binding energy in the case of disk accretion is the binding energy at the inner edge, at the marginally stable orbit. So for a Schwarzschild hole, it's 6%, and it could be up to 42% for a maximally rotating Kerr hole. That's if you have disk accretion and you're able to radiate the binding energy. Now, that's what is radiated, of course. What is observed is this one, UBH, divided by the typical redshifts you lose a factor 1 plus E because of Hubble expansion. So what we observe today, it's what is radiated divided by the typical redshift of, if you want, quasar activity. We know that's about Z equal to, that's where the quasar number density peaks. And so in fact, the energy density, the radiation energy density that we observe today, that we expect to observe today from black holes, just from fossil records, will be about 50,000 solar masses C squared. Don't need those numbers anymore. For an efficiency of 10%, 1 plus Z over 3 to the minus 1. Okay? Now we can compare this estimate with what we actually see. After all, we do see quasars. We do see quasars. We look at quasar counts. We can count how many quasars there are in the universe. And the energy density observed today from the quasar population is just the number of quasars with a given flux times their flux integrated. So just an integral of the number counts of quasars. I'm just saying that all black hole accretion onto black holes is powering quasar. It's the only way we know powering quasar, but okay, so what I'm saying is from the fossil records of how many black holes we see today, we expect this amount of radiation, if the efficiency of accretion is about 10%, to be observed in the universe. Now if I then assume, well, quasar equal AGN, let's see how much do I get from AGN. The number is about between 5,000 and 10,000 solar masses C squared per cubic megaparsec. So it seems that the QSO light seems to underpredict, if you want, there are several ways you can put this, but it underpredicts the observed black hole masses by about a factor of 5.
UBH is supposed to come from all the black holes.
Yes, these are just fossil records. Okay, this is the, I compute how much mass there is to
be. Black hole, the center of our galaxy, is not,
yes,
very luminous.
Right. So. Well, I'm going to go.
It must have grown.
But what I assumed is that there must be some phase over which it got that mass by accreting gas, and it must be radiated with a given efficiency, and that's how I get that. I'm going to talk about lifetime of quasar activity. Anyway, there seems to be the first discrepancy in all this game is this factor of 5. Now that means that either there are lots of hidden AGN at high redshift that we have not detected. There could be. A lot of people now are talking about very dusty objects at high redshift. Dusty quasars have been invoked as a possible explanation for the X-ray background. There are some heavy dents in the submillimeter. There is a new instrument called SCUBA. You detect very bright sources at high redshifts. A large fraction of those sources are identified with AGN. So one possibility is that there is a large fraction of AGN that are being missed at higher redshift. The other possibility is, in fact, the efficiency of accretion is much less than 10%. It's, in fact, 5 times less than 10%, if you believe this number.
Are we assuming that at some stage all black holes are accretion?
Yes. Exactly. I assume that all black holes grew through accretion.
Well, the mass is due to accretion.
Right. If it's due to merging, and then yeah, might talk about that later, then that's not true anymore.
This is what your formula assumes, that the mass comes from,
yeah,
accretion.
Yeah.
Why don't we count it as evidence for mergers?
Sorry?
Why don't we count it as evidence for mergers?
You can. No, I mean, people are doing it. Well, it's a possibility, but again, but that basically means that this efficiency will be much less than 10%. So it's another way of rephrasing that. Either low efficiency, so they merge, they build up mass without radiating, or there are many more AGN that we see.
Okay.
What fraction of galaxies of AGN?
I'm going to go to that too. It's about at z equal. It depends how you play the game, but it's about 1 in 1,000. So bright galaxies. So I hope I don't need this stuff anymore. Okay, next. Quasar here. So we covered 1 and 2. Now if you look at the quasar luminosity evolution, or if you want the quasar luminosity density, the space density of quasar as a functional redshift, this is relative space density. Then it goes up as 1 plus z, and this is always commoving. When I talk about per unit volume, it's always unit commoving volume. Space density goes up as 1 plus z to the 3.5, which is a peak at about 2.5, and then drops. This is equal 5, let's say. Now, and it's also, I think, instructive to remember that in Einstein, the Einstein universe. Let me put it that way. Redshift versus age, z, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. That's Hubble time in giga year. So this is 13. Today, 4.6 as equal 1, 2.5 as equal 2, 1.6 equal 3, 1.2 is equal 4, 0.9 giga year as equal 5. Okay, so z equal 5 is about 7% of the current age. So the epoch of maximum quasar activity is a redshift between 2 and 3, corresponds to about 2 giga year. At that redshift, the commoving space density of bright quasar is 4 by 10 to the minus 7 per megaparsec cube. Now, we have now a very good understanding of what is the space density of bright galaxies, or of galaxies, if you want, at the same redshift as z between 2.5 and 3. The reason is, in the last few years, people have been developing a very efficient technique for finding high-Z galaxies. And very briefly, it uses the fact that there is a lot of neutral hydrogen along the line of sight to any high redshift sources, and that neutral hydrogen is going to absorb all radiation below 1 Rydberg. So when 1 Rydberg goes through your optical passband, so let's say in the blue band that would correspond to z equal 4, then we have a feature to identify high Z galaxies.
Can I ask another naive question? What's the reason that the quasars only exist in this narrow redshift range?
Why he does that, we don't know. I don't think we know. There are some models.
I mean, if you think of it as forming black holes, by accretion or something.
Well, these two, for example, this could be this. If merging has anything to do with it, then maybe, it's the merging rate that is dropping here. And if black holes are only in relatively massive dark matter halos, those are formed relatively late, and so you have to wait for those to form, to accrete gas, go to the center, lose angular momentum, form black hole, then accrete more gas. But beyond this, and you can try to model that, and people are trying to do that these days, but you don't know. Now, the space density of galaxy at the same redshift of bright galaxies is about 3.4 10 to the minus 4 per cubic megaparsec. Okay, so that means that a fraction n quasar of n galaxies of order 10 to the minus 3 of bright galaxies is a bright QSO. Now, from local fossil records, which is the stuff I was describing at the very beginning, we believe that every galaxy harbors a black hole. And we can reconcile that observation with this ratio with a duty cycle. In other words, if every bright galaxy had a single QSO phase, this would last about 10 to the minus 3, which is this ratio, times the Hubble time at the quasar peak, which is 2.5, and that's of order 2 by 10 to the 6 years. It's a very short time. Short duty cycles, that's why only 1 in 1,000 of the galaxy that we pick up at high redshift has a black hole. Now, short relative to what? Well, the Eddington luminosities, which is the luminosities at which the radiation force on electrons due to Thomson scattering, it's balanced gravity, it is 4 pi g mp over sigma t. For 10 to the 8 solar masses, black hole is of order 10 to the 46 ergs per second. Associated with this luminosity, so if the luminosity exceeds this,
C.
There is C here. Thanks. So there will be. I have to check all these formulas before it goes to the web. Yeah, but then G must be one. Okay, this corresponds to an Eddington accretion rate. Eta is the efficiency of order 2 solar masses per year for an efficiency of 10%, and this a black hole mass of 10 to the 8. So that's a sort of, if you are able to radiate efficiently, that's the sort of maximum accretion rate you can sustain before you blow everything through radiation pressure. And there is a characteristic time scale. You see now that the accretion rate at this limiting rate is proportional to mass. So mass will grow exponentially if the hole is radiating at the Eddington rate over a time scale T Eddington, which is equal m over m dot e, which is equal to 5 10 to the 7.
Radiation rate that balances the infrared stuff.
Yes. Well, for this accretion, it's the same. If you are able to radiate all the binding energy, then there is this limiting accretion rate. Beyond that, in fact, in disk accretion, what happens is that if you are super Eddington, as you perfectly know, you puff the disk up, it's not thin anymore, you push the inner edge, the efficiency drop, etc., etc. But anyway, it's a good way of looking at things. So this time scale here, it's much longer than this. And that's an exponential time scale. It's an e-folding time scale. So that means that through all this argument, there is the disturbing conclusion that QSO seems to accrete quasar, or if you want, supermassive black holes during the quasar phase, seems to accrete only a tiny fraction of their mass in the bright phase, because the duty cycle is short. Unless they accrete at super Eddington rate. Well, unless they are radiatively inefficient as well. Right. Another way of looking at things, if you want, is that the density, and again using this Eddington type of argument, is that the space density of black hole, the space density of AGN radiating about 10 to the 46 ergs per second, at that redshift is this number here. And locally, if you count how many of those 35 cases, how many black holes have masses of about 10 to the 8, which corresponds to that, if L is of order L Eddington, well, that number is 1,000 times greater. It's again the factor 1,000 that you find it here. So there is sort of number crisis here. And the interpretation is, again, more heat than AGN. If there are more AGN or more quasars at higher redshift, then the space density of quasar would go up let's say by a factor of 3, and then the duty cycle would come up by a factor of 3, and you would start, well, you don't gain a lot with factor 3, but at least you push this number up, maybe closer to this. Not close enough, though. The other possibility is that black holes would grow, as we were saying before, because hierarchical clustering merged black holes and the halo and the galaxies together. Now, if you look, you can try to simulate this. People have been doing that for the last 10 years. Simulate merging rates and how fast things merge in the past, etc. You start from a primordial spectrum of density fluctuations, and then you let those evolve. And the merging rate is typically of order a few, maybe up to 10, but not much more than that. And so basically what I'm trying to say here is you might be able to grow black hole masses by a factor of a few through merging instead of through accretion. And so maybe a factor of few there because of hidden AGN, a factor of few there because of merging, would give you timescales that are long enough to be able to exponentiate the black hole mass and grow it. Finally, the possibility that is being discussed at the this astrophysics program a lot is that accretion may occur with low relative efficiency, so this limit would not apply, and so that would mean that you can a black hole would be able to swallow much more mass than this limiting rate, and there are ways that might happen, and so you would be able to grow a black hole much faster than this number here. Okay, this is what I wanted to say about black holes at low redshifts, see less than 3. So let me try to say something else about higher redshifts. And the issue there is, do we have any evidence for quasar type of activity? Hence, for the paradigm that I've been using here for black holes, at early time in the universe, times where we don't have very many sources, we don't have enough statistics to go through the argument that I gave you so far. And the big issue that is being discussed these days is that, for example, did black holes form together before or later than the first stars that we know ionized the universe? We know, in fact, that the universe is ionized as equal 5. The way we know it is we look at the spectra of the few quasars that we know exist at that redshift. In the red frame UV, if the universe it's neutral, then you will be able to see no flux below Lyman alpha. That's because recently scattered photons will be taken away from the line of sight. You see an absorption trough and no residual flux. So in other words, if you look at the spectrum of the quasars, this is frequency. It would be Lyman alpha, so this is long wavelength, this is short wavelength. It would be Lyman alpha and then absorption. Here, nothing below Lyman alpha. That doesn't happen. There is a spectrum of a quasar 4.9, very good spectrum that shows residual flux below Lyman alpha. The universe is ionized at those redshifts. Now, so what can we say about that? Let me give you another piece of information. So let's focus our attention on the universe as equal 5. We know that the universe at that redshift, it's also clumpy, and I'll tell you in a moment why this matters. This clumping factor here, it's about, which I'm going to call C, here it's about few tenths. Let's say 20. Sorry, that's square. Okay? In other words, the universe at those redshifts is far from uniform. If you can, we see the Lyman alpha forest in the spectra of those quasars, so we see discrete absorption lines everywhere at those redshifts, Lyman alpha clouds, But also from numerical simulation, we know there is a lot of nonlinear structure already in place at that redshift.
In the vicinity of the quasar.
Everywhere. Right, the quasar line of sight is probing, you know, you probe the entire Hubble volume through that line of sight. And the reason this is important is that the recombination time of hydrogen, it's equal, well, that recombination coefficient times the clamping factor here, times the average density. And this is of order 10 to the 8 years as equal 5. And that's about 10% of the Hubble time at that redshift. So the universe at that redshift is clumpy and recombines fast. We know it's also ionized from this type of argument and several others. And that means that we need a lot of UV photons to keep it ionized at that redshift. Many more that would be required if the universe had the same mean density but was spatially uniform. The clumpiness of the universe means that it recombines fast. The recombination time scale is 30 times higher than it would be if the universe was uniform. So there is a minimum amount of UV ionizing photons that you need co-moving volume, a co-moving emissivity that you need to keep the universe ionized at that redshift. And this is given by the hydrogen density times divided by the recombination time. And this critical rate is about 2 × 10^51 ionizing photons per second per megaparsec cube. This is what we need as equal 5 to keep the universe in the thermal ionization state that we think it is. Now, this number is comparable with the amount that is emitted by quasar as equal 2.5 at the peak of their activity. So we are here now, z equal 5. This is what we require. This is what we get at z equal 2.5. But then the quasar space density dropped. There is another factor of 5 missing here. Bright quasars seem not to be able to produce enough UV photons to ionize the universe at z equal 5. So in case you want to invoke quasars at those redshifts, for example, faint quasar, you know, there is always an argument there that we only see the bright end of the luminosity function. If there are lots of faint quasars that have not been detected in optical surveys, then you could boost this number up. By how much? Well, you need as many UV photons as there are as equal 3. Well, you need those numbers as equal 5.
Do these results depend on the cosmological assumption? So mega matter equals 1, z equals h equals
0.5? Not very much. It depends. It depends on the clamping factor, and also here, so for the recombination time scale, and also depends on essentially, it's clamping factor and omega baryon. But I'm using the number of baryons from nucleosynthesis, deuterium, and the clamping factor is both what you get, close to what you get from observation and from numerical simulation. So, again, to within a factor of 2, we are not probably too far.
So why did you need omega n equals 1 to begin with? Why did you make that assumption?
To go through all this number without carrying the cosmology with me. I could have assumed an open universe, omega matter 0.3, omega lambda 0.7. Then some of the estimate I would have needed to do numerically. So it's just for convenience. But you know, it doesn't matter. Cosmology will not matter too much. The only thing that matters is the state of the IGM, whether we got the clumpiness right and whether we got the baryon density right, not the matter density, the baryon density, and that's just limited from nucleosynthesis. So let's see. Let's go through the argument again. Is what about mini quasar if you want mini black holes? We know the gas is photoionized at that redshift, as equal 5. And so the gas temperature of the IGM is going to be of order 2 by 10 to the 4 Kelvin, 20,000 Kelvin, just due to photoionization. So the gas is going to have that temperature. And through numerical simulation, of course, well, I mean, the real number is got through numerical simulation, but anyway, the argument is this gas at this temperature can only be accreted by dark matter halos having virial temperature that are a few times higher than this. If the virial temperature is smaller or is comparable to this, the gas is not going to fill the dark matter halo, and so it's not going to be accreted. It's too hot. So if you want to form galaxies, okay, if you want the baryons to be accreted from a dark matter halo into a galaxy, cool, form stars, black hole, etc., you need this type of virial of temperature. So this corresponds to velocity, circular velocities of order 50 kilometers per second. That's a sort of minimum, well, it's in different units, but it's the minimum mass, minimum circular velocities that objects at that redshift will be able, forming at that redshift, will be able to have. And that corresponds to a mass, that's dark matter, of order 4 by 10 to the 9 solar masses. So a halo of this mass will be able to accrete the gas from the intergalactic medium, cool it down, and form a galaxy. If it's less than this, then the gas will not fill that potential well. So you'll have a dark matter halo without a galaxy. Now, so that's dark matter times omega baryon, which is 0.08 in these units, times the 0.6% that was the conversion between mass in the galaxy and black hole mass, you get 10 to the 6 solar masses. So that's the minimum black hole mass if objects at that redshift have the same relation that we see today, is the minimum black hole mass you'll be able to have at that redshift. Now, that corresponds, if you want, to a luminosity, if it's Eddington limited, of about 3 times. Can this go up? Well, anyway, you can hear me. Sorry.
Pull it down.
Push it. Well, it doesn't stay up. I can push it. But pull it down. It's not getting any better, guys. I'm a theorist, but
just rip it off.
I leave the director of the other. See? Okay, so this one corresponds to about 3 10 to the 46 ergs per second. Sorry, 44. It was too bright. So this would be faint AGN, mini black holes, keeping the universe ionized at that redshift. And again, since I need the same amount of UV photons at that redshift, then I see as equal 2.5 in smaller objects that are 40 times less bright than the bright quasar as equal 2.5. That means that I need 40 times more AGN at these redshifts. So if the universe is ionized as equal 5 by mini black holes, if you will, not that mini, but still, 1 million mass black holes in dark matter halos of only 4 by 10 to the 9 solar masses, this corresponds to dwarf galaxy. It's not a massive galaxy. Then I need 40 times as many AGN at that redshift as I see at z equal 3.
Our galaxy
would
be...
I'm not saying we are off. What I'm saying is, If we do imaging survey, I was trying to say that this number is ruled out by observation, but yesterday evening I was not able to prove that. So maybe it's ruled out already. But the issue there is that if there are lots of mini AGN in the universe, small AGN, faint AGN at high redshift, we should start to see them in imaging surveys because the space density is huge. So when we go deep with the HST, for example, in our image, we should start to see evidence for point-like sources that seems to be associated with AGN at high redshifts. This could be sort of the source that are responsible for keeping the universe ionized as equal 5 and maybe re-ionizing the universe at slightly earlier epoch. So this reionization of the universe seems to be a big topic these days in the cosmology crowd. The reason also being that we are hitting, getting higher and higher redshift these days from surveys, and if you go through some of more detailed modeling, as some of the simulations are shown there, there is some evidence, or the model seems to predict that the universe will be ionized as less than 10, between 5 and 10, maybe 7. So there is some real hope that we should be able to probe or to look directly to the ionization of the universe in the next few years by going in the near IR, through near IR surveys, for example, seeing high redshift quasar, high redshift sources, and do spectroscopy on the bright one, and then try to see an effect of a lot of neutral hydrogen along the line of sight. How much time do I have? 5 minutes to another argument. So the other argument now goes, what about this was AGN, black holes, etc., keeping the universe ionized? Okay, and then the issue is, what about the first generation of stars? That's the other model. Quasar, what came first? Stars, a lot of them, or many of them, that ionize the universe, or quasars, or at the same time. Okay, now, what happens when I form one solar mass of stars? If I do that, when about 8%, given what astronomers call a Salpeter initial mass function, 8% goes into massive stars. These are stars that have more than 20 solar masses. These are the stars that have enough, that produce UV photons. Less massive stars don't contribute much to the ionizing photons production of a galaxy. So during the lifetime of one of these massive stars, about 50% of the mass is converted into helium and carbon, releasing the usual 0.7% of radiation. 25% of the radiated energy goes into UV photons, into UV radiation at energies greater than 1 Rydberg, so ionizing photons, of typical energy, 20 MeV. Now, believe me, this calculation is usually done with stellar population synthesis model, but I think once you've done that, then you can go back. And it's not that I did that. That's not the way I did it, but anyway. So, oops. EV. Okay, so if you put everything together, you end up by saying that for every one solar mass that you form, you have 0.08 times 0.5 times 0.07 times 0.25 over 20 electron volts times solar masses C squared divided by year. So every year you form one solar mass, you end up with 10 to the 53 ionizing photons per second. Okay, that's the magic number for today. And you remember that to keep the universe ionized as equal 5, we need about 10 to the 51 photons per second per megaparsec cube. That means that the star formation rate, if I don't want to use quasars and I want to do it with stars, then it means that the star formation rate per unit co-moving volume as equal 5 must be of order 10 to minus 2 solar masses per year per co-moving megaparsec. So if I'm forming stars at this rate, then I'll be able to keep the universe ionized. Now that doesn't seem a lot, but this is comparable to the amount of stars that we see being formed as equal 3 and as equal 1. Then it drops. In other words, if you plot in the redshift range between z equal 0 and z equal 5, let's say this is z equal 3, the amount of stars that are produced per unit co-moving volume, the number is again, the curve is similar to what quasar seems to do. It goes up and then it stays pretty constant. Maybe it goes, it drops a little bit. We have a point as equal 3, another point as equal 4, and then. So basically, we need as many as equal 5 again, as many stars that are formed as equal 3. There seems to be, through those arguments, both quasars and star forming galaxies, there seems to be no evidence, if you want, for a decrease in activity in the universe in this redshift range from z equal 5 to z equal 3. However, of course, if you integrate over time, this amount of star formation rate times the Hubble time at that redshift, it's about 1 giga a year, you get that only, you need to form only 1.5% of the stars that we see today to keep the universe ionized at that redshift. So it's a small number. We are going after the 1% of the stars seen today that formed at those redshifts and ionized the universe. And again, we have evidence, for example, through Lyman alpha for a study that there are metals in the universe at that redshift. And again, so the argument is, well, if we form enough stars and those are in shallow potential well, then we can eject the metals much more easily than in bright galaxies. So that's where most of the action is in high redshift study and cosmologies and cosmology these days. I could go into X-ray heating but an X-ray background, but I think I'll stop here and maybe take a few questions.
So when people model this in the numerical simulation,
yes,
they have to have, of course, cosmological scenarios, dark matter.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. That's okay. The problem is these days is the radiation transfer. This is a state of the art simulation, not because I am a co-author, but because the guys that did it are people that do those for a living, like Mike Norman and supercomputing center, etc., etc. That's one source.
What is this actually?
It's a quasar. So what you're seeing here is the intergalactic medium, clumpy. So that's the result of a large-scale numerical simulation. So you see all the filaments, etc., sheets that form in the universe. And then in the dense cell, this is equal 8. In the high-density cell, you form a quasar. Gas cool, and you're saying you're forming a quasar, and the quasar drives an H2 region and start to ionize the surrounding gas. So now that simulation has no hydro. It's only relative transfer. So the hydro code solved for the AGM structure and then it doesn't do anything else. Then you switch on a source and you follow. And it's one source. So I think in the next few months we'll be able to do two sources. But if you want to do a large scale simulation of how the universe is reionized, that's far away in the future.
Do those numerical studies affect, how do they compare with
inspecting
the envelope?
Well, the issue there, of course, I was using some of the results of those simulations, for example, in the clamping factor. So at that point, you know, they agree. The other thing that they have to do is we don't really understand star formation very well. So you can track the amount of gas that is cooling in the universe in this simulation. But then at a certain point you say stars are formed with a given efficiency. And you don't know how efficient the process is. So you have to go back to the observation to get some hint of what's happening, and then basically you end up with the same, with, you know, within factor two, with the same number that I was giving here. Mm-hmm. So it's you know, you can follow dark matter halos easily, but once you start to get into the gas dynamics, heating, cooling, feedback, supernovae, etc., then it becomes messy, and you cannot do that from first principle. You have to do a more phenomenological approach.
Did you answer the earlier question about M33, which is historical accident, that there's no black hole there?
I don't think I answered that. I think there was a related question, is how long was the quasar activity? So I think I tried to answer that. The special case of M33, or why some galaxies don't seem to have black hole, I don't think we know.
Okay. Can it be historical accident, these scenarios seem to indicate it's very...
Well, most of these arguments are statistical. So, you know, in principle there could be a few objects that are massive, that don't form massive black holes.
And they are not massive black. M33 is 10 times or 4 times less massive than our galaxy.
Yeah, but still, you know.
Those were the only ones that emerged.
Very compact balls.
I don't remember the morphology of M33.
We don't know much about the relationship of blood and black hole. That's the relationship between couple types. The other thing is, of course, there's an easy way of knocking black holes out of galaxies. If
in the merging, yeah. right, and in fact, this is the sort of thing that
three body
merging.
If you have a binary black hole, then you have a three body.
You're right. I forgot about that.
A fairly large space for knocking everything out of the galaxy.
Galaxies collide with black holes and
they don't get knocked
out.
That can happen. Yeah.
I mean, so if you have three body merging,
if you have a third merger, a third collision with the galaxy before the first two black holes merge.
And the black holes have the same mass, then you have a three-body problem, and you know, slingshot, and you eject the black hole. So there are ways to form naked galaxies, not naked black holes, but naked galaxies.
But that must be quite a cataclysmic event. So is there evidence of that in M33 that something like that
may occur? It wouldn't be that cataclysmic. I mean, the effects of a merger are probably wiped out.
No, in maybe
2 years. It could have happened at high redshifts, and so, you know, if it's high redshift enough,
then merged that recently because they have well-defined disks.
No.
How much variance is there in this relationship between the black hole mass and the ball?
Oh, the scatter is not small. I have the errors not here, but I could give those numbers. It's not small. I mean. Well, I don't remember the scale, so I could. So it's not incredibly tight. It's not a extremely tight relation, but you can see it by naked eye. You don't need Kolmogorov's Smirnov test to end up with it. And it could. No.
Is there any understanding of which comes first, the galaxy or the black hole?
There is no understanding. Most of the things I was describing today have happened in the last couple of years, so people are working on it. No, there is no understanding. It's one possibility is as the gas collapses and cools into this dark matter halo, somehow it managed to get to the center, gets high density, and form a black hole. You have to find an efficient way of losing angular momentum there, and people have worked on you know, a very high redshift. If you do it as Z100, then you can use Compton drag because the radiation background is so intense. That's a very efficient way of losing angular momentum. But at this more modest redshift, like Z=10, etc., then you have to invoke something else. Like at that point, people say, well, maybe magnetic field. You transfer angular momentum through that, and then you can form a black hole at the very early stage. Then if it starts to accrete, then it can drive the formation of the galaxy itself, right? Because it will heat up the gas and so determine, if you want, what happens later. Conversely, you can form a galaxy, then the gas starts to cool, you form stars, and then you have a star clusters, and then at the end you end up a black hole. So that's why people are trying to push the redshift limit and try to find more quasars at high redshifts and see what comes first. A few months ago there was this announcement, and there is a paper last week in the web, the Sloan has found I think there are 15 quasars Z greater than 4.3 or something, and there is a new record holder as equal 5. But their number, but of course they are exploring a large chunk of the sky, and so their number density seems to be consistent with this drop anyway. Well, there seems to be plenty of galaxies as equal 5. So if you just look at that relation, there seems to be something happening, maybe stars from first. But well, thank you.